Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Fire Engineering Radio, to our show Pride and Ownership, the Love for the Job. I'm your host, Chief Rick Lasky, and we've been off to a great start with this series, and hopefully we'll keep it going for a long time. We've had Professor Glenn Corbett on the show last couple of shows, and we're going to have him on again today in a couple of minutes here, and probably our next one. And we've been getting a lot of great feedback, a couple emails yesterday from a couple different firefighters. One of them was just keep it rolling. They love what they're hearing. A lot of folks have never had the opportunity nor the resources to hear the stuff that Glenn's been talking about with the history and our heritage and everything. I mean, this is where it all started. This is why we're at where we're at today. And it's a lot often, we skip over that in our fire academies, or we just breeze through it. And that's a shame. We need to get back to where it all started and really cover that stuff for our new firefighters so they know what we're all about. A couple quickies. Bobby Halton, our editor-in-chief, Chief Halton, mentioned a site. When we were talking about museums, this is a site for firefighters when you're traveling, that everything from museums to different firehouses that will welcome you. If you're from out of town, if you want to see rigs, you want to do ride-outs and that. And the site is called The Visiting Fireman. And there's actually a book you can subscribe that you can carry with you when you're going out of town. But the Visiting Fireman, and the website is www.visitingfireman.com. All right, visitingfireman.com. It's a great website, a great resource, and I thank Chief Halt to us because there's so much to talk about. I forgot to even mention that. There's another great organization when we start getting into honor guards later, and has to do with flags, and I'm a flag nut, and it's a great resource as well as the North American Vexillological Association. And that's NAVA.com. And that's, if you're a flag buff, that's the organization to be with. They are, a vexillologist is a flag expert or enthusiast. And I love it. It's a great resource with a lot of great information on flags, not just from our country, from all over the world. had a great visit in Highland Park, Illinois, just this last week. And in Highland Park, again, they're on the north side of Chicago. Couple really cool things I was just telling Chief Corbett is not only do they have like their mini museum, like so many fire departments are doing with their stations, but they've got a book, and a lot of departments will do this. Unfortunately, not as many as we'd like to see, but they've got a book on the history of their department that was done several years ago, and it's absolutely incredible. I mean, what a great with the pictures and the stories and the facts regarding the history of the Highland Park, Illinois Fire Department. And it's something that they hand to their rookies, and which got me thinking, if we can get more fire departments to do that about the history of their department, what a great, what a gold nugget to place in the hands of your new guys and gals, new men and women walking in the front door to get them to really understand, what your department's all about, and what a great, great thing. And lastly, before we get started here, another thing that Peter and Bobby have told me about is if you want to subscribe to these, I think this is really cool. Again, the website is awesome. If you want to subscribe to the podcast, to the radio shows, and that's everything that they've got going besides Pride and Ownership, but Bobby's been doing some of the other folks, and we've got hopefully a couple other of our board members. We're kind of hoping that we can get maybe Professor Glenn, and I'm gonna start guilting him on this, but maybe once a month to come on and just do a maybe pick a fire. We'll talk about that a little bit to talk about. But you can actually subscribe to that, and you can subscribe. There's a button you can hit when you get to where you're going to download. Choose a download, save. There's a subscribe button. You can subscribe, and that'll go right to like iTunes. If you've got that for your iPod, that service, it'll load it right to it, and then you can load it right onto your iPod. You don't have to do any other. If you're like me, and you're lucky, you can turn your computer off and on. It's really easy to do. So, and if you need any information on that, I'm sure he wouldn't mind. Contact Peter at Penwell. His email address is Peter P. P as in Paul. So Peter P at Penwell.com, and I'm sure he'd be happy to give you the instructions on how to get those things loaded and get you going. So, enough with that. Good morning, Glenn.
Hey, Rick, how you doing?
I'm doing great, brother. I told you, I listened to the show a couple times yesterday, and I get fired up every time I listen to what you talk about. And you know, the other day, there was just we got on a roll. We had a third alarm fire, and we actually had unfortunately had a backdraft. These guys, this thing, one of those sneaky ones where you get something caught up in a void space that I think a lot of guys, Glenn, they look at the books and they see the picture of the indications of a backdraft, and they see that smoldering room with the little vapors coming off the couch and the door being open, and they don't realize that there are times where you can have a fire venting out the back of a building, the doors open, everything else, and still have, especially now with these homes with these humongous attics and void spaces, that you can still have a backdraft even though the buildings open up. I think a lot of guys don't realize that.
Yes, well, especially in confined areas, basically. That's, Frank Browning had talked about it for years, having backdrafts actually in ceiling voids, things like that.
Oh, it's just it. In fact, I think Chief Bass from Grapevine, I love him to death. He and Homer Robertson, as I've mentioned several times before, the reason I'm in Texas, and great guys. We were talking about one that they had in Dallas years ago, where I believe he was thinking they had gotten on a scene and reported fire through the roof, or was actually fire through a skylight, and the attic was, just pressurized and waiting for that oxygen to get to it, and when a member pulled down the attic stairs, it let loose, and I believe it ended in a bad way with a line of duty death. But it just it just goes to show you that I don't think fire reads the books. I don't think the fire follows policies and guidelines. I don't think it pays much attention to what we're doing if we're not doing the right things. Do you agree, Glenn?
Yeah, well, we have to pay attention to what it's doing. That's the key.
Exactly. So, well, enough about that right now. Let's get back to some of these things that people have been asking about. And Glenn, there are a couple things before we move into some events that if I could get you to just discuss briefly. First of all, can we talk about musters? When I talk about a fire muster, certain parts of the country, there's a lot of firefighters that aren't aware of what I'm talking about. And I know it might be hooked to a certain region, but explain what a muster is to us, or that kind of stuff.
Well, basically, a muster is an assembly, I guess. And we talk about, in general terms, even beyond fires, we say muster up or muster. It's usually to mean to bring together, to assemble, that kind of thing. And in fire service terms, musters have been around since the 19th century, and basically, they came out of the desire to assess the capabilities of the firefighters who brought hand pumpers, basically, or using hand pumpers to see who could best the other in terms of the length of a stream, or how far it would travel, and how quickly they could get water to the pump or to the hand pumper and things like that. So it's a competition, basically. And they actually still exist to this day. They're the New England League during the summer months still has musters where different departments bring their old hand apparatus and they go through all the procedures of trying to basically best each other on the playing field, essentially. So musters, we talk about musters, we think about hand pumpers, we think about, again, throwing the furthest stream, that kind of thing. And that tradition is still carried on to this day, especially in the New England area, although we hear about it in California and some other places. It's like I said, it's a fun day for everybody involved.
Well, and I've been to what was the one years ago, the Allentown Thaw, I believe they call it, or
yeah, that actually for some of your listeners, some of them may remember the Valhalla, New York, Fairchester Hose Haulers muster. That was in this era, basically. That was the heyday, the late 70s and early 80s, when apparatus was brought from the entire New York City region, basically up into New England, up to the Kensico Dam in Valhalla, New York, and actually not only included hand pumpers, but steam fire engines and motorized apparatus, Aaron's Foxes, and all sorts of neat things. But it was a pretty dramatic event because they actually drafted water right out of this reflecting pool at the base of this gigantic dam in at the Kensico Reservoir. And for those of you, the older guys that are on that may remember that, it was quite something. And you know, it's basically it's a part of our history and things. And as you mentioned, Allentown each year in April, around the time of FDIC, actually is a get together for fire historian enthusiasts, who especially firefighters who collect memorabilia and things like that. It's usually held, the spring thaw. It's usually held, like I said, April. Usually, I don't remember the date off the top of my head for this year, but if you Google it online, you'll find when it actually occurs.
Well, I know if you bring $500 or $1,000 to spend that stuff, you better get a U-Haul, because you can get to a lot of places in the country, Glennie, I've noticed, where some of this stuff is just outrageous, and some of your best buys are going to be when you get into these swap meets, into these musters where guys are, besides the contest that it's the trade show of being able to buy in, old helmets and, nozzles and all the, just the, all the stuff that's exciting, old tools and light bars and just, if you're a fire buff at all, and I know they've got them in Chicago, we're going to actually host one in here probably about a year from now in Louisville. We're going to get that going here. Like I said, the Texas Fire Museum in Dallas is a great way to sponsor a lot of different events, right here in Texas. But, Glenn, you're right, and there's some pretty cool things. Now, I mean, you got the musters, and I remember looking in those books you turned me on to. You were talking about some of the contests where, whoever got that stream the highest neck, they used like a pole as a measurement device, and a lot of these guys were beaten – with the hand pumped engines were beating the steam engines still. It was almost like, is that where we got into the I know there's kind of two terms we talk about, wetting downs. There's being wet down, and then there's wetting down a new rig. Is some of those contests, can you visit a little bit about of that stuff?
Yeah. And we talk about, you talk about the mid 19th century when steam fire engines, first, came to the forefront. You had a situation where, there was a lot of opposition, obviously, to the steamers, and one of the things that resulted was competitions between hand pumpers and steamers. And yes, there were situations where the hand pumpers actually threw a further stream than the steamer did, but unfortunately, of course, the steamer could go on for hours, throwing a stream with minimal effort, whereas the hand pumper wears out after 10 or 15 minutes of high velocity, use of the brakes, as we talked about in a previous show. They wear out pretty quickly. So it really kind of shows the benefit of steamers is that obviously you didn't need as many people and it could run for indefinitely as long as you had, as long as you had a fuel basically. But, as far as wet downs go, of course, the term wet down's been around for quite a while. We use it here in New Jersey, right? I am quite a bit in this particular part of the country. In the sense that, it was a great day when a department received a new piece of apparatus, and there was always, of course, this tendency to want to try to best your other, local fire company, basically, and that kind of thing. And so, the term wet down, really applies to actually where the departments would come in and give it a baptism of water, I guess you could say, by playing water onto the new pumper and things like that. And actually probably to some extent comes out of what happened many, many years ago with the hand pumpers, that it was a really bad thing if you were the foreman or essentially the captain of an engine company, a hand pumper, when a company who was supplying you with water, so if you're on a relay, basically, you were pumping from one hand pumper to another, it was a really bad thing if the company who was supplying you with water was able to supply it at a rate faster than you could pump it out of your pumper, because essentially what happened is the water would actually come boiling over the edges of the of your hand pumper, and you essentially would have been called washed, basically, which was a major embarrassment. You didn't want a situation where the company who was supplying you was able to provide you with more water than you could handle, basically. And so that's, again, that's part of the competition. And, you know, the use of water and washing each other and that kind of stuff, you know, of course, I think is, to some extent, the legacy of the wet down, in that, you know, you want to show, you know, even though you certainly appreciate the new apparatus and have fun and stuff like that, it is fun to try to mess around a little bit with your other local fire companies, basically.
Well, and that's still, Glenn, you know, we've talked about that still goes on today with all the different firehouses out there. I mean, just here, you know, out of all our firehouses, the, you know, between the three shifts, actually, I always tell people I have four shifts, A, B, C, and D, my day shift. But between the engine and the truck guys and the quint guys and, you know, and it's a lot of it, as long as it doesn't go too far.
Right.
You know, and we can tell those stories off the air sometimes where things have gotten a little bit out of hand. But for the most part, our firefighters, these men and women are passionate about where they work. And that's the pride. You know, actually, it's kind of a neat thing. If it's taken the right way, that's, I think, Glenn, what you and I have been talking about, trying to instill back in the men and women in the fire service, is to get that pride back to where, you know what, there's nothing wrong with, you know, hey, we got first water, we got in there first, you know, we hit it, and, you know, kind of thanks for coming and helping us, you know, afterwards kind of stuff. And nobody means it, you know, in a mean way, but I think that's some of the pride that kind of gets you back to wanting to take care of your rig a little bit better and all that.
Yeah, and you know, as you say, being first in the scene and having first water on the fire and not giving up your nozzle, I mean, those are all things that come down to individual company pride, basically. And of course, again, you have to just be careful that can easily evolve into competition, basically, and you know, and that's not, in some cases, not a good thing. So
no, we still need
it. You got to keep it under control, basically.
Exactly, and we still need to be a team, and we still need to take care of business for who we're taking care of, and that's the people
right.
that have the houses and the businesses out there.
Right.
Now, the wetting downs of new rigs. I know we do it here, and I know the. There's a battalion chief in Arlington that's doing it with his crews, and I've talked about Joel Hewitt up in Minnesota, and, you know, getting a lot of different departments that are starting to do it again where, you know, I guess along the same lines where, you know, you don't put, like you said, you don't put the rig away, the new one away, without giving it its first bath.
Right.
And, you know, you push it in, and that was a ceremony, and a lot of times before that, you push the old rig out. But in doing my research, I've come to find about half the time, there was no push out of the old rig because the old rig may have been destroyed in a fire or it was just broken down. And but a lot of times it was the push. And we're doing this now, Glenn. We do either an actual push or a simulated push where we have the captain of the house do the wetting down. Then we have everybody jump up and help dry it off, including the visitors and the kids, the children. You can even go to like Sam's Club or Costco, whatever, buy a big bundle of towels, and we have it stenciled with the event on the towel, so it's kind of a keepsake. And then when they're done, you know, drying it off, everybody puts their right hand on the rig, and the chaplain blesses the rig, and then we push or do the simulated push into the station. Dispatch, you know, cracks the speaker and sets off the station tones and retires the old rig and welcomes a new one. And it's just, and then we, Glenn, take a picture with the crew that put it in service, all with their hand on the bell. And we do that, and then, you know, those four pictures get framed of the, you know, the wetting down, the drying it off, the push, the bell, along with the radio announcement. And, you know, I had a councilman ask me once, Rick, you know, why don't you get a new bell for this rig? It looks a little dinged up. And I said, well, boss, this bell has already been on two rigs, and it's going to travel 100 years from now. This will have went from rig to rig to rig to rig, and everybody that placed it in service and worked on it, you know, is going to have their hands laid upon it. We even have some guys that still, most of the time, when the last rig to leave the fire rings the bell, kind of tapping it out, just, you know, having some fun. So, I mean, there's a lot of neat things that are still going on out there that people are trying to do.
Right, and I think, you know, we talk about bells and things. Bells are really interesting in the sense that, you know, they were the only audible device really on apparatus, you know, and really the bells actually came more into play with the steam fire apparatus years ago. Of course, there were no sirens or things like that. So, but of course, today the bell has become more of a traditional accoutrement to the apparatus than it is a functional one, you know. I mean, you've got things that are, of course, much louder and more extensive than, you know, than the bell. But some departments, including my own, actually carry the bell from one older piece of apparatus to the newer one, basically, and inscribe
and
on the side
here,
of it, you know, where it comes from. So it's a passing down of that tradition and things, you know. So so that's the deal. That's, you know, that's the situation with bells.
Well, and Glenn, what I was starting to say when you were explaining that, do you feel? I mean, I'll get chiefs sometimes, Glenn, that'll ask me, you know, do the guys think it's corny that when you do these ceremonies and, you know, whether it's the retirements or the wedding downs, you know, there's always that nervousness the first time you do it. Like, what are the guys thinking? Oh, geez, what's going on here? And do you find what I have found, Glenn, that it actually is the opposite? The guys really, I think they get
they
into
look forward
it
to it. And,
yeah.
Yeah, I think, and you're actually creating your own traditions, you know? I mean, you're creating traditions that are based upon actual, you know, events of the past, basically, you know, and you create your own ones.
Well, and it kind of spreads. You and I were talking off air before we started today. You know, there's things, everything from all the firehouses and the how we're starting to build them again, where they're looking like old firehouses. Would be like, we're doing one here with bifold doors and a watchtower with a bell in it and everything. And,
And
the red lights on the firehouses. We put red lights on the firehouses here, and the guys went nuts. They were like, finally, you know, and we talked with a few of them that weren't sure why, and we explained kind of the history behind the red lights on the firehouses. And I know that's one of those, Glenn, we've talked about. It's hard to nail down exactly the origin, but there's several out there if you get to the right folks, and I think you and I have, where we, you know, there was a reason when you looked down the street and you saw the red lights, you knew the firehouse was there. If you looked on top of, you mentioned and talked about call boxes, you could find a call box that way.
Right.
And then, Glenn, in New York City, I know this because my buddy John Salka, Chief Salka, has pointed them out every time we're there. You know, if you're in the city and you run out to the street and you don't have your cell phone, you're looking for a call box, you can look in either direction to an intersection. And what are you looking for that'll help you indicate that there's a call box there?
Well, unfortunately, for the last 10 years, there's fewer call boxes out there. I don't know if guys are aware of that, but several years ago, New York City decided to get rid of a lot of the boxes and stuff. But the ones that are remaining out there, if you're to stand on the street corner, you look and you see an orange globe up near the traffic light level, basically, that indicates that there's a box on that particular corner there. So I know the one where I teach at John Jay in the city, unfortunately, the one at 59th and 10th has been removed and just the stanchions there and everything. But the active boxes still have the orange lamp, which, of course, you know, talked about on one of the other shows. Remember, these are the voice boxes that New York City uses today are, of course, a direct descendant of the pull boxes. And those pull boxes, they were essentially telegraphs. So it was important for the firefighters to know where the boxes were anyway, not so much even after the call was given, but be able to use that box to communicate with their dispatch center if they wanted to sound additional alarms or whatever. So the orange globe or orange lamp that you see today it goes back a really long time.
And you can see those still in some of those intersections, like you said, and you can see the little orange LEDs on top of the streetlights if
right.
you don't have the globe you're looking for.
Right.
But, and that's just the kind of stuff that I think helps. I mean, how expensive is it to do that on the front of your firehouse to bring back a little bit of that pride and that little bit of our, you know, our heritage, if you will, to how things looked way back when?
Sure.
But, you know, I mean, it's just, I don't know. I think we're missing some of that stuff, buddy, to be honest.
Yeah, not really.
Well, can we let's move a little bit forward into some of the things that a lot of the men and women are. I'm sorry about the sirens in the background, but it's getting busy here. So we talk, and Glenn, you've referred to them as notable events in American fire service history,
sure.
And in the tradition class, it was one of those things that you wish you had an 8-hour day. I mean, that you talk about a workshop.
Sure.
For HOTS would be an 8-hour day to do that class where people would be in there just, I mean, eating all this stuff up. But one of the first ones you had listed was, it was 1678 and the first fire engine brought to America. Can you kind of take us through that and how, you know, where some of these rigs started coming from way back when?
Sure. Well, you know, Rick, when we talk about, you know, fire history, you know, we're talking about, you know, the very earliest fire history in the initial settlements in America, you know, those were nationally based settlements. So Jamestown with the English or, you know, in Florida, we had the Spanish, up in New England, we had, you know, the, Puritans that had come over to Plymouth, and then later on, of course, the Dutch and different, all sorts of different nationalities coming to America. Well, of course, they brought their fire protection, if you want to call it, mentality with them. And so for many, many years, you know, we had these settlements in America with really no fire protection on them, perhaps buckets and things like that. And of course, it became pretty evident as these cities grew, Boston or New York or Philadelphia, what have you, that we needed better firefighting equipment. And so one of the first engines you actually see, if we want to term it that, we see is up in Boston in the late 1600s, where this portable four-legged, they didn't have wheels on it, four-legged hand pump that had to be carried to the fire scene. I don't know why no one figured out what wheels would be better, but anyway.
You put wheels on something, these firefighters.
Oh, they would actually have to pick this thing up and take it, and then, of course, it didn't have any hose on it, so they actually had to fill this thing up with water with buckets, and then essentially would pump it as a hand pumper, and then the water would squirt out at the end, of course, out of a nozzle, which, of course, you know, the effectiveness of this thing is pretty limited, of course, because it doesn't go inside buildings, and you know, you have to be pretty close to the building to actually get water on it. So, you know, it was pretty crude kind of stuff, you know.
Hey, Glenn?
Yes.
You know, not to interrupt, you know what it reminds me of? You said something just when you said, because I know which one you're talking about, where there's no hose, so you've got to have it lined up where you need it. I mean,
right.
In position.
Right.
It's almost what we've done with deck guns today when we don't take them off and put them on the ground. That depending on where you park your rig,
right.
You know, and the angle and how high it is and everything else, it's almost, we're almost back to that, you know.
Right. I mean, before there was hose on engines, you basically were limited to that nozzle on the top. And that really carried on really into the 1700s. You know, it was then that we actually introduced the leather hose, of course, and allowed us to move that stream of water off the engine, basically. But yeah, it was pretty crude equipment and not particularly effective, I would imagine. So, but these earliest engine, New York City gets its first engine in 1731. As a matter of fact, for you, those of you who are planning a trip, here's a plug for the New York State Volunteer Firemen's Association, Firemen's Home in Hudson, New York, up the river above New York City, about an hour and a half or so above New York. Probably one of the best fire museums in the world, basically. They
really?
Actually have one of the two original 1731 pumpers up there.
Where's that at, Glenn?
In Hudson, New York.
Hudson, New York.
Yes, Hudson, New York. It's if you Google it, you'll find a really wonderfully done website. It's the Fire Association of State of New York, FASNY, and you can look at their collection and things online. And I tell you, it's a remarkable place. Like I said, it's number one on my list of best fire museums out there. So
wow.
So it's a great place to visit. And like I said, you'll see one of these original 1731 pumpers there, one of the two. And those actually were imported from England. They were imported from England. So again, that's where, you know, as I said before, you know, a lot of these burgeoning American cities rely very heavily, of course, on Europe to essentially provide all of its need, including, you know, its fire protection needs as well.